It is Thursday, October 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton faces a congressional panel on the 2012 terrorist attack on Americans in Benghazi, Libya. A U.S.-Iraqi raid frees hostages held by the Islamic State. South African students protest proposed university tuition hikes.
So the students gathered today, they sang traditional South African struggle songs, and they gave a list of demands to the General Secretary of the African National Congress, the ruling party.
And we look at the new film, Rock the Casbah. It's all ahead. Former U.S. Secretary is facing a long day of questioning before the Republican-led Special House Committee investigating the deadly 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. The attack led to the deaths of Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other Americans when Clinton was the country's top diplomat. In her opening remarks, Clinton struck a conciliatory tone. She praised the lives and careers of the four people who died in the attacks, and she expressed a willingness to help the committee determine what the factors were that led to the incident.
Despite all the previous investigations and all the talk about partisan agendas, I'm here to honor those we lost and to do what I can to aid those who serve us still. My challenge to you, members of this committee, is the same challenge I put to myself. Let's be worthy of the trust the American people have bestowed upon us. They expect us to lead, to learn the right lessons, to rise above partisanship, and to reach for statesmanship.
Democrats, including Clinton, have seized on remarks made earlier this month by House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy during an appearance on a Fox News program. McCarthy appeared to boast that since House Republicans created the special committee looking into the attacks, Clinton's approval ratings have dropped. I'm joined now by VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Well, the hearing is continuing, but Jim, so far, how has Mrs. Clinton done defending her actions regarding Benghazi?
She has defended her actions. She's been pressed by the Republicans about why she didn't pay more attention to security concerns about the Benghazi compounds leading up to the attacks in September of 2012. And I would say the overall tone has been somewhat subdued. Certainly from her point of view, she's trying to answer the questions clearly, succinctly, not get too excited. Most of the Republicans are also sort of careful not to cross a line. There was one heated exchange, though, with a Republican from Ohio, Jim Jordan, who was really pressing her on the conflicting explanations early on in the administration's view about why the attacks occurred, whether it was a spontaneous demonstration sparked by an anti-Islamic video. There was some tense moments there, but so far not as many fireworks as one might have expected.
Well, and how did she respond to that?
Well, she was, in fact, saying that they thought from the first it was a terrorist attack, but it was also clear that when pressed, she had made other comments and the administration and the State Department had come up with other explanations at the time. She said it was a confusing time. So this is one area the Republicans have focused in on before. And that's the other point to make here, Sarah, is we've had several investigations going back a few years now. So the question for today's hearing is, what are the new revelations? The chairman, Trey Gowdy, has said they do have a lot more emails from her and from the ambassador who died, Chris Stevens. But so far, we're covering a lot of the same ground we've covered before.
And it seems, I mean, I've read accounts that Republicans are feeling somewhat pressured because they don't, particularly in light of what Kevin McCarthy said about this was sort of, I mean, he basically, the gist of what he said, it's almost like they were trying to almost look for, you know, get Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I mean, there have been comments from the Republicans that it's about politics. They tried to take them back. Obviously, leading up to this, that has set the scene. So Republicans have to be aware that the image of them going after her for political reasons could be a real problem. You know, the other thing to say here is this is really Washington political theater at its height. You have here the leading Democratic candidate for president, a possible future president, exposing herself to a day of questions, often from unfriendly Republican sources. So it's quite the spectacle. But so far, the fireworks have been less than expected.
Yeah. And I guess it remains to be determined how this will affect Mrs. Clinton's presidential campaign.
It does, though. She's had a very good week or so with a good debate performance and the decision by Vice President Biden not to enter the race.
All right. Thanks very much. That's VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Well, now for social media reaction, I'm joined by Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what has been the reaction to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's appearance at these hearings on Benghazi?
Well, as Jim alluded to, it's splitting kind of along the same lines of Republicans and Democrats. We're seeing that on social media, where you have Republicans who are being highly critical of the things that she's saying and her actions. You have Democrats that are saying she's putting on a good performance, giving good answers, and the Republicans are really attacking her. Several people noting, as Jim also mentioned, that she looks very presidential sitting up there. So they say it's great optics for her to be up there talking to these Republicans. And then, of course, you have the people that are making the jokes. My favorite so far that I've seen is a image that they say, best of luck to Hillary Clinton and everyone else who's spending 8 hours answering ridiculous questions from their coworkers today. So people making light of it as well, saying it is kind of political theater and that it has been rehashed and just kind of the story keeps going around and around again of Hillary Clinton goes up to the Hill, they ask her questions, it goes back and forth like that, and it's the same old, same old. So just it'd be interesting to see if any other key moments pop up on social media. Some moments so far people have been noting, but it's been generally pretty tame. We also have trending today on social media a new feature from Instagram, which is the photo and video app where you can share photos and videos. It's called Boomerang. Not quite a photo, not quite a video. It's kind of somewhere in between. What it does is it takes a series of photos over about 5 seconds, and then it plays it back and forth, kind of like a boomerang. You can go back and forth, back and forth. So the examples they've been showing are people blowing bubbles, and the bubbles go out, the bubbles come back in. People blowing gum bubbles, things like that. Riding bikes, it looks like the bike is going back and forth. So people are really embracing this all of a sudden. This is kind of the new way to share photos, a new way to share something that's not quite a photo, not quite a video. People comparing it to a GIF online where you see this kind of looping images, short looping images. So it'll be interesting to see how people use this on Instagram and if this really takes off and whether companies, maybe Twitter or Facebook, who's partnered with Instagram, if they integrate that into their social media.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Well, in other news, a joint rescue mission by U.S. and Iraqi Kurdish fighters has freed about 70 hostages facing execution by Islamic State militants. But in the battle in northern Iraq, one American serviceman was fatally wounded. The first member of the U.S. military killed in the year-long campaign against IS extremists. I'm joined on the line by VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, what is known about this mission?
Well, we know that the U.S. forces who are advising and assisting in Iraq were asked to help out by the Kurdistan regional government. They said, we have this information. We know that there are dozens, and that we find out now that there were about 70 hostages that are under imminent death. All of the intelligence was telling them that it looked like there was going to be a mass execution. So dozens of the Kurdish Peshmerga forces and U.S. forces went in to free these hostages. It was in a prison facility by the Islamic State in Hawija. Now, Hawija is west of Kirkuk. It's not too far from Beji, which, you know, there's fighting going back and forth there between the Islamic State and Kurdish Peshmerga forces and Iraqi security forces. And they were able to go in and successfully rescue the hostages. As far as we know right now, there were none of the hostages killed. Five of the Islamic State terrorists detaining these were killed. Four Peshmerga forces were wounded, and we have heard that, unfortunately, one U.S. service member, as you said, was killed. There was a gunfire, and he was shot during that gun exchange. He was removed to Erbil and given some medical treatment, but unfortunately, he did not survive.
What is known about those the people who were rescued?
Not much at this point. We do know that about 20 of these rescued were members of the Iraqi security forces. Now, I've heard conflicting reports. We're hoping to get this straightened out in about 15 minutes when the Pentagon has a briefing. But right now it's unclear who the other people were, whether or not they were Kurds or whether or not they were Iraqi Arabs. We do know, I've been told by a U.S. official, that none of them were Westerners. So these were Iraqis, be them Kurds or be them Arabs that had been captured by the Islamic State.
All right, thanks very much. That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Anyone who has done a headcount at a large gathering knows how frustrating and monotonous this task can be. Now imagine you're working for a large corporation or government agency and you need to determine how many people participated in an event that attracted thousands of people. The long and boring process usually involves people who examine aerial photos of the crowd. The photos may be overlaid with a grid of cells a couple of centimeters square. Then, one cell at a time, the counters tally the number of heads per cell. Researchers at the University of Central Florida have now come up with an automated crowd counter. The software they created allows a computer to scan aerial photographs and then count the number of people in the images automatically. The software creators say that what had taken a week to complete can be done in as little as 30 minutes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about the new film, Rock the Casbah. In South Africa, thousands of university students are protesting proposed 10 to 20% tuition hikes. Demonstrations have occurred in both Cape Town at the parliament and in Johannesburg at the headquarters of the ruling party, the African National Congress. I spoke with VOA Johannesburg correspondent Anita Powell. She just returned from the ANC headquarters.
So this afternoon we saw between 2,000 and 3,000 students and supporters of the Fees Must Fall crusade, which was launched about a week ago here in Johannesburg over proposed tuition hikes at the University of the Witwatersrand. So the students gathered today, they sang traditional South African struggle songs, and they gave a list of demands to the General Secretary of the African National Congress, the ruling party.
And what were those demands?
So the students say that they want no fee increases or tuition and fee increases. They also want some accountability. They say that the higher education minister, Blaise Nzimande, might need to step down. And they're also calling on the ANC to deliver on promises it's made in previous campaigns that higher education would be free.
First of all, what has been the response by the ANC to this?
So earlier today, the Secretary General of the ANC, Gwede Mantashe, kind of turned on, of all people, university administration. He said this is the fault of the vice chancellors who just raise fees without consulting and they make unilateral decisions. So the ANC so far seems to be saying, well, you know, this isn't really our fault, it's the fault of the universities. The university chancellors, vice chancellors, are of course saying, well, we're supposed to be mostly publicly funded. Public funding has not kept up with inflation. And the only recourse we have as costs go up, as demand goes up, is to get that money somewhere. We have to push it onto the students. So right now we have, for lack of a better way of putting it, the grown-ups pointing fingers at each other and the kids, which they're not kids, of course, but the students pointing fingers at their elders and saying, fix this.
How violent have these demonstrations been? And I believe some students are facing charges in regard to this.
Right. So Wednesday, students in Cape Town marched on the country's parliament, and they did clash with police. I believe it was water cannon, rubber bullets, and tear gas, and 29 students were arrested, including, very interestingly, the son of the vice chancellor of the University of Cape Town. So these students were held overnight. They're mostly out now. So there have been clashes. Here in Johannesburg, the two main universities, the University of the Witwatersrand and the University of Johannesburg, are very close to each other. So the main arterial road that kind of connects them has been the scene of angry students who have hit cars with sticks and so on and so forth. But here in Johannesburg, it's been okay. We are hearing at this moment reports of tear gas being fired inside the University of Johannesburg, but I don't really have any details on that at this point.
Are the protests expected to continue tomorrow and maybe during the weekend?
Not only are they expected to continue tomorrow, students are going straight to the presidency. And President Jacob Zuma is going to meet with student leaderships and discuss this. So this has gone all the way to the top. The students today at the gathering today in Johannesburg said they aren't going to give up. They're not going to stop. So it is likely that unless we see some sort of resolution, we're going to be seeing these for a while to come now.
All right. Thanks very much, Anita. That's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. A down-on-his-luck rock music manager finds himself stranded in Afghanistan. But there, he discovers a young woman who could change his whole life. International Edition's David Byrd has this look at Rock the Casbah, which stars comedians Bill Murray, Kate Hudson, Bruce Willis, and Liam Lubani.
Richie Lanz has seen better days during his career in rock and roll. Lanz, played by comedic veteran Bill Murray, takes his last client and assistant Ronnie, played by Zooey Deschanel, to Afghanistan to perform for the troops there.
You will play in front of 2,000 horny soldiers.
I'm gonna hurl. Oh, my God.
I'm sorry, but I can't tell if you're vomiting or laughing.
When Richie finds himself dumped and stranded in Kabul, he discovers Salima Khan, a Pashtun girl with a beautiful voice who wants to be the first woman to compete in Afghanistan's version of American Idol. At the film's premiere in New York, Bill Murray said that he felt this movie was something special, even as they filmed it.
I haven't felt this way in a long time, that something unusual was happening, that we were really jumping over what was written and what was expected, making something much better than what we walked into at 6 o'clock in the morning, and walking out of the day, every day going, I don't know. It started with, hey, you know, this might be good. Hey, you know what? This could be really good. And then it was, I think we really got something. I think that's what we have.
As Murray's character navigates Afghanistan, the film also gives audiences a look at some of the consequences of the war there.
What the hell am I doing here?
Richie Lanz, talent manager. How y'all doing, guys?
Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Back at you, babe.
Bill Murray says that the film used comedy as a way of getting into the deeper subjects, and it was a challenge to maintain the comedic element when dealing with more serious subject matter.
So that's something that we thought we could get away with, and not get away with, but succeed at. And then the idea of making the story right was going to be determined by the people about whom we were speaking, people from both Afghanistan and the Muslim world. And those people seem to think that not only is it very successful on a human level, that it's respectful, but that it's entertaining too.
Rock the Casbah director Barry Levinson says that he prefers to use comedy to address tough subjects, because that is what real life is like.
I think that sometimes, you know, behavior and real kind of humanistic behavior has a tendency to have humor mixed in with its more dramatic moments, as opposed to saying, well, this is supposed to be dramatic and therefore it's important, or this is a full-out comedy, that the blending of it tells you more about human behavior, for me personally.
Actress Liam Lubani, best known for her Oscar-nominated role in 2014's Omar, plays Salima, who dreams of singing on television. She says that the film ultimately is about shared humanity.
Well, for me, I think, although it's like a comedy, but it basically shows two human beings from a completely different, you know, world come together, put hand in hand, and help each other achieve what they want, which is, you know, I think it's such a humanistic story in a way that I think Barry was pretty genius to do that.
Rock the Casbah is rated R for language, including sexual references, some drug use, and brief violence. The movie opens in U.S. theaters October 23rd. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
So, sounds like quite a movie coming out. Well, that's our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A little more than 4 years ago, the first ripples of unrest in Tunisia signaled an end to the despotic regime of Zine El Abidine Ben Ali and a shift toward democratization of Tunisian society. But what the Tunisian people inherited from the previous regime was a state apparatus crippled by hollowed-out institutions, rife with corruption, and security forces meant to protect the status quo to the detriment of the people. Nonetheless, despite numerous challenges, including an increasing rift between political movements, sporadic civil unrest, and increasing violence, Tunisia slowly and steadily progressed toward democracy. It dismantled the police state, forced opposing political parties to make compromises, held two open and free elections, and last year adopted a progressive constitution. Much of this progress can be credited to Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet, a group of four organizations: the Tunisian General Labor Union, the Tunisian Confederation of Industry, Trade, and Handicrafts, the Tunisian Human Rights League, and the Tunisian Order of Lawyers. The group helped stabilize the fracturing country by drafting an agreement of compromises that served as a roadmap to negotiations and insisting that all parties who wanted to participate in political negotiations must sign the document. 21 parties signed the document, allowing a national dialogue to commence. The Tunisian model of inclusivity and respecting fundamental freedoms of all its citizens is the best answer to the violence and extremist ideologies that have torn apart other countries in the region, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. For its decisive contribution to the building of a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia, the National Dialogue Quartet won the 2015 Nobel Peace Prize. The United States congratulates Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet on this well-deserved award. This extraordinary honor recognizes the critical role civil society organizations played following the Tunisian Revolution. By preserving national unity and constructing a political process that led to both the Constitution and free and fair national elections, said Secretary of State Kerry. Their inspiring achievement is a shining example for all societies that are working toward an inclusive transition from dictatorship to democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Straight Talk Africa. Host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the upcoming elections in Africa and consider what makes an election credible to the extent that it reflects the will of the people. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.